Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Well, hello and welcome back to the Smart Family Podcast. I am your co-host, Dr. Rob Meter, here with Tony Newhoff. And today we return to a somewhat familiar topic. Tony, we've talked about this topic a few times with our guest, Dr. Mike Seitzma.
So Dr. Michael Seitzma is back with us for the third time. And just a heads up for you parents, this is an episode about your physical intimacy. And so you may want to listen to it either on your own or with your partner.
Yeah. So Mike Seitzma has been working with couples in a variety of capacities since 1987. So he's been doing this for decades. He is a licensed professional counselor in the state of Georgia. He is a certified sex therapist and a certified professional counseling supervisor. He's also actually an ordained minister with the Wesleyan Church, and he has served as a staff pastor for churches. And he is currently appointed to Building Intimate Marriages.
In our earlier conversation with Mike Seitzma, he mentioned that he had some ongoing research in this area of sex and marriage, and now he has just recently released a book called Secrets of Sex and Marriage. He co-wrote it with Shanti Feldhahn, and Rob and I have this opportunity to unpack all of that for you, so let's get started.
Dr. Michael Seitzma, welcome back to the Smart Family Podcast.
Thank you. It's an honor. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, we've had you here before, and I'll tell listeners to check out episodes 3 and 47, where we've had some really interesting conversations with you. I know for me, it was eye-opening, and I'm sure our conversation today is going to be equally interesting.
So, Mike, you are a sex therapist, and you've had many years of clinical practice helping couples. And recently, you did some research. We'd love to hear more about the study that you've done, its methodology. And did you have a particular hypothesis in mind when you set out to do this research?
We actually had several of them. You know, if we go back, I studied, I went to get a PhD in therapy thinking I would study therapy, but getting a PhD from a tier one research institution meant I took 7 doctoral level courses in research and methodology, and kicking and screaming, I got drug into my love of research. My initial dissertation was on sexual desire discrepancy in married couples. And I did original research with 150 couples, and that definitely got me hooked. So over the past 20 plus years since my PhD, I've continued on with doing research on marital sexuality, sometimes just to see what's trending, what's shifting, what's going on, sometimes to ask specific questions of it. This was the largest project that we've done. It was a 4-part project, the core of it being 2 nationally representative studies, meaning we collected data from people across the nation that reflected the 2018 census data. So we had people from various ethnic groups roughly reflecting the census data, people from various ages, from all 50 states, obviously more in those that there was higher population. But you're looking for a sample that is not what we would call a convenient sample, easy to get. But one that as closely as possible represents the average kind of couple in the U.S. So we wound up with 1,097 married individuals. And then the survey that I am most proud of and have spent the most time in is 501 married couples. So we've got both the husband's and the wife's data. They didn't know how each other was responding, so it's fairly accurate, and we could ask cross questions like, what does your wife think? And then we could ask the wife what she thinks. And we could ask, what does your husband think? And ask the husband what he thinks. And so that allows us to do some cross look at how people misunderstand each other or do what we call in the field misattribution. So the first question was simply, what is the current state of marital sexuality? COVID has not been particularly kind to married couples and to sexuality. And then several other hypotheses, including probably the prominent one for me, is the impact of healthy sexual communication on a couple's marriage and sex life, things like frequency and desire levels and orgasms. And so just looking at the impact of sexual communication.
So this is relatively recent data then, Mike, because you're talking about the COVID pandemic here.
Yes, we wrapped this up in kind of, it would be probably mid-2022, early 2022, that we finally wrapped it up and have been working on. It's a lot of data between the four surveys. The fourth one was a convenient sample of couples that were coming to marriage workshops. So one that's, you know, a more distressed group of couples, 250 couples. So we've got all of those samples, and it's been a lot of time in just crunching the data. Now I'm trying to make sure when you're studying couple data, there's a lot of additional research methodologies that you have to attend to because they're married to each other. So their answers obviously influence each other. Mm-hmm. And so when you're analyzing the data, it's a lot more work, which makes it more fun.
Yeah. Now, before, and I can't wait to dive into some of this data. I'm sure you're going to share some exciting findings with us. But before we do that, I just want to preface our conversation with the fact that sometimes people can be abused through physical intimacy in the context of a committed relationship. What are some of the red flags for abuse? In case we have perhaps a listener joining us today mm-hmm. with whom this is resonating, what's their next step towards staying safe?
If we think past abuse, we have a huge number of the population that has experienced some type of abuse. If we're thinking in terms of the current relationship, I'd probably say the key that we would watch for clinically is that of consent. If someone is forced, if they're coerced into any kind of an act, it's likely an act of abuse. And spouses can abuse one another, even sexually, especially sexually sometimes. I've worked with both husbands and wives who have been raped by their spouse, and many others who, under threat of some kind, felt like they couldn't say no. You know, if someone has to have the freedom to say no to truly be able to say yes. So if there's a sense that I can't say no, it's worth, that would be a flag that I'd want to attend to and dig a little deeper into it.
Mm-hmm. And the next step towards safety, if somebody finds that this is resonating?
Yeah, if you're hearing some of the flags for your own relationship, I think the key is to risk talking to somebody that's safe. They need to help you to think through, is this a safe environment for you? And most importantly, what would be a safety plan? I work with a lot of clients, and what is the safety plan to keep yourself safe if it does get more unsafe than it is? Or how do we exit it and step back so we can see if we can't find safety in the in-between that allows you to step back in? And when we're sometimes in therapy, we talk about being inside the box and outside the box. When we're inside the box, it's tough to have a good perspective on it, an accurate, honest perspective, and having a trusted pastor or physician or therapist, coach, somebody that can set outside of us that we trust, that will maintain confidence, that can help us to think through it, to develop that safety plan.
I really appreciate your comments on that. Switching gears, we do want to focus on all of the research that you've done. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could comment on, like, what is the top-ranked myth that couples still believe about their sex life?
It may be tough to think of the number one, because I think there are a few of them, but I would probably say one of my soapboxes is couples believing the myth that men need sex. You know, it's one of the things that's talked about in a lot of books, and there's this underlying kind of a belief in it when people are talking. And the reality of it is we've spent millions of dollars trying to prove that sex is a need. It is for our species, obviously, to continue on. But we were, there are plenty of people that are single, plenty of people that choose a celibate lifestyle for a variety of reasons, and they do just fine. Sex is not a need. It's a God-given desire that draws us together to help us to connect. When we believe it's a need, I feel like we really diminish both husbands and wives. When we say to a guy, you're an amazing person, you are a holy warrior of God, you and your buddies, you know, can go up against a lot of stuff can be accomplished. Oh, except to your sexuality. That's in control of you. You know, you have to have that. And then we teach them that they deserve it and it's a right. And therefore, if they're not getting what they want, they feel justified in pursuing it. And similarly, when we say that it is a need for a husband, we move women into their primary role is to be a meter of his need. And women are far more valuable, far more precious. And our sexuality is far richer than to just be a meter of somebody's need. You know, most men want to be desired, want to be chosen, want to be pursued. And if somebody feels like it's my job to meet a need and I have to, it robs the beauty and the life out of it. And it robs the beauty of who they are as a person. So I would say probably one of the, you know, I could talk for a long time on it because it's so box of mind, but you know, the myth of men needing sex would probably be one that I would push back against pretty hardly.
Just a follow-up to, you know, we looked at what is a myth. What about the number one mistake that couples tend to make in regard to their sex lives?
Again, I think there could be a few different things here, but if I would pick on one, it would probably couples not learning to talk openly about sex as a couple. I don't think it is normal for couples to talk openly about sex. You know, it is a sacred subject. It's something that we just intuitively have some fears around and, you know, will I be accepted if I'm open? And, but couples really need to learn how to talk about sex in an open, healthy, respectful, honoring manner. That was one of the things we looked at in the study, and we found some pretty amazing shifts in couples that talk well and couples that don't. So we divided them into three groups, those that kind of have normal communication about sex, those that are particularly poor in their talking with each other about sex, and those that are one standard deviation above, or they're particularly good at talking about sex within their relationship. And those who are great communicators, 38% of those couples had sex more than twice a week. While over 50% of those who are poor communicators were sexless, had sex less than once a month. So we see this massive difference in couple in frequency. Satisfaction was similar, 95 for husbands and 98% for wives who are great communicators said that they were satisfied with their sex life versus only 50% of those that were poor communicators. You know, good that 50% of them are, but those that were great communicators, we moved it up to 95, 98%. So talking about it, learning how to be open and sharing with each other is huge. Couples that don't do that, I would say that that's probably the number one mistake.
You say that couples who take a curious approach, and I suspect that's kind of, linked to this openness to talk about sex, for example, in marriage, the couples who take a curious approach, they kind of discover a bit of a superpower. How does, maybe fill us in on the secrets of that, and how does that practically play out, this kind of curiosity about sex? So that's not so much a taboo sort of in the background thing, but maybe something that is explored more deeply by the partners.
Yeah. So if we approach anything with a critical, a condemning, a complaining kind of an attitude or spirit, if I move into it demanding that you be something that I want you to be, because of our humanity, we immediately go on the defense and we push back. We're either going to blow up, cave in, or run away. None of those help us to really effectively communicate. Where if we can go into it with a curious type of a stance, it creates an environment of openness where we can begin to unpack who we are with each other. If we do take frequency as just a quick example, a common thing for me, and I think we've talked about this before, but a common thing is to ask couples, you know, how frequently would you like, would you feel good about? And the lower desire person will often, you know, stay pretty close to what the higher desire spouse says. And the higher desire spouse says they're looking totally shocked. And that is a key moment for me, because how they respond is critical. If they look and go, wait, what? You really want it that much? They've moved into a curious stance. And now we can actually make progress because they're trying to understand. And the next question is, wait, if you want that, why isn't it happening? And now we're both on the same page trying to figure something out. If it's, no, you don't want that. We've tried for years. You're never, and they move into a critical or condemning or complaining kind of a stance. We shut the whole process down and the couple can't even begin to move forward in finding. You know, a couple that's laying in bed and beginning to touch each other, and one of them says, oh, that doesn't feel good. If the other one gets all huffy and bent out of shape and wounded and hurt, and the process shuts down. But if it's, oh, really? Can we figure out what does work? What does feel good? And they'd be curious about it. Now we have a playfulness and an openness that allows the couple to expand, and we've created a safer space to even figure ourselves and each other out.
So if it's true that a healthy sex life is part of an attachment, like part of the bond of marriage, how much of a role does sex actually play in that? Did your research have a look at that connection between physical intimacy and how satisfied a couple is with their relationship?
We didn't look specifically at attachment theory and attachment models in the research. We did show a strong connection, which has been consistent in all research, between couples who feel satisfied and safe in their relationship and marriage, and a healthy frequency of sexual satisfaction. Sex is connected to attachment, but I like the way you said that as a part of a secure attachment, because it flows both ways. Sex flows from a secure attachment and it contributes to a secure attachment. You know, sometimes couples come in and they're coming for a lack of sexual intimacy, but I sit with them for a little bit and I tell them, you guys aren't ready yet. Your marriage is no longer safe enough to be truly that intimate. It's no longer safe enough for you to enter into who she is, or it's no longer safe enough for you to allow him to enter into who you are. That's a very vulnerable, sacred act. And the attachment is not safe enough. Maybe one of them has brought something unhealthy into the marriage, or one of them is threatening the boundaries of the marriage in some other way, or they just don't feel safe and secure. You're not curious and trying to figure me out. You're demanding who I be. And so the attachments aren't secure, so healthy sex is not going to flow from it. But once we begin to develop a healthy attachment and we create a boundary that makes it more secure, then sex can begin to grow. And then all of the chemicals that come in having sex with each other, the oxytocin, the vasopressin, the dopamine, and all of these host of chemicals that flow from healthy sexuality reinforce that secure attachment and bond us together even more and more. There are obviously a lot of, sex is so complex. There's so many things that go into it being good and us desiring and wanting. And then sex contributes to those. And attachment is one of those where it goes both directions. So definitely a part of it. Mm-hmm. I do struggle when somebody's, when a professional says, well, just go have more sex and you guys will be fine. Often that's not the right answer because the only kind of sex they're going to have at that point is unhealthy sex. And we have shown that even things that we laud like oxytocin put in the wrong context can be detrimental to the relationship when it's paired negatively. So we want it to be safe and secure as we step into it. And then that reinforces it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that kind of comes up from time to time, and I think we've talked about it in our past episodes as well, and I'd love for you to maybe touch on it again this time, is this concept of how some people are kind of wired to be initiators and some are more wired to be responders. I'm just curious, how hardwired is that? Like, is that sort of the way it has to be, or how do you maybe rewire yourself so that maybe that can be more variable rather than sort of fixed?
Honestly, Rob, we don't really know. The concept of initiating sex, or sometimes it's called spontaneous desire, versus a receptive or responsive type of desire has been talked about for decades now in our field. And research is continually being done on it. But desire is so complex. We don't really understand intensity of desire, why some people seem to have such low desire, why some people seem to have such high desire. And when we don't understand it, we don't know how to change it. So it's tough to increase desire. And for those that feel like their desire is way too high, we have a hard time trying to decrease it. We don't understand direction, why some people are attracted to blondes or to redheads or to brunettes or different body types or different genders, or we just don't understand it. So we have a hard time changing it or shifting it. And we don't understand type very well. It does seem like it changes with setting. A woman who tends to be more of a initiating type of desire early on in marriage, post kids, often is going to be more receptive type of desire. We don't fully understand that. We don't know if it's something that shifted in her body, if something that shifted in how she views herself. We're not really sure. In teaching receptive desire and how it works, I often hear men who are over 50, 55 go, wait, that's me now. You know, something has shifted in me. I was never like that when I was younger. I've wondered what was going on. And they're identifying that it has shifted. We will see sometimes a change in a relationship, that something traumatic happens and really draws them together. That can shift whether they are more receptive or more initiating. Somebody who tends to be more receptive in a day-to-day life, and they go off on vacation and they're kind of high in life and well-rested, and they may all of a sudden be very initiating in their desire. And that often comes as a surprise to them. You know, why can't I be this way all the time? Yeah, sorry, we don't really know. How do we change it? I don't know that we do. We can change the intentionality. In other words, I can choose to be intentional in the discipline of my sexual life. And that can come across as more receptive or more initiating. But I don't know that we know enough to say how to shift the innate part of who we are.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned earlier how the perception that, you know, the desire for frequency, let's say, is maybe less than we actually think it is. Like sometimes in our mind, that difference is maybe exaggerated. Do you think that that's true also for this difference between, you know, an initiator versus a responder? Like, you think maybe that's more exaggerated in our minds than it actually is, that we make a bit too much of it?
I don't think so. Okay. It's possible, but most people that I talk to aren't very aware of the different types of desire. So they only view it through the concept of an initiating type of desire, that the belief that that's the only kind of desire. And if we go back into the into our field when receptive desire was first talked about, many professionals said, well, that's not legitimate desire. And yet, if you offer me chocolate, and I haven't been thinking about it all day, but now you've talked me into it, to say that I don't really want it because I didn't want it before we started talking, well, that's not legitimate. You've talked me into it. Now I do want it. My desire is very real. But we, in this research, we looked at couples and we asked who tends to be the typical initiator and who tends to be the typical receptive. And then we put them in a grid because, you know, we kind of think that the media and culture tends to teach that both a husband and a wife should be initiating in their desire. They look at each other across the room and, you know, the sparks fly and they're ripping each other's clothes off and we're ready to go. And so we wanted to know. And the reality of it is only about 10% of couples said that we are both initiating in our typical kind of desire. You know, that's going to vary a little bit, but the bulk of couples, one of them was initiating and the other was receptive. And that's how most couples are. And so I think that difference very much is a real thing. And part of the problem comes that we don't allow each other to be different. You know, we don't allow, got a couple that I was working with this morning, and she's the more initiating type of desire. And he keeps looking, saying, there's something wrong with you. So that you're that initiating. And to be able to say, no, there's nothing wrong with her. That's just how she is. And she's saying, there's something wrong with you that you're not initiating. No, he's actually receptive. That is perfectly okay. And you guys make up a normal marriage that one is initiating and the other is receptive. But I want him to pursue me more. Yeah, I'm sorry. His receptive desire, he's not thinking about it that way. You know, he needs to get aroused before the desire kicks in.
But I guess the risk is, though, that someone who's never initiating, the other person might perceive that as maybe passive rejection.
And sometimes it is. You know, sometimes a spouse is withholding or punishing. But generally, my experience is that's not the case for couples. They don't realize that one of them is a more receptive type of desire. They don't realize that they have to be aroused before the desire kicks in. Once they understand that, they can move from that critical complaining about who you are to challenge accepted. You know, I can seduce you. I can draw you into this space, and we can light the fire such that the receptive desire kicks in. And that mindset shift from there's something wrong with you to wait, there's probably something I can do here that would draw you in, can be huge in a married couple. But they have to accept that, yeah, we approach this from differing sides of the table, and that's perfectly okay. That is the rare couple that approaches it from the same side. Mm-hmm.
You're reminding me of a story that Michelle Weiner Davis told about a couple she had. He said, can you tell her to write "I like sex" on her wrist? Because she keeps forgetting. So it's pretty clear what their roles were.
And sometimes that helps because that can be enough to spark the receptive desire. But typically, the person with receptive desire not only needs to have that thought, but their body needs to be awakened. And then they need to be able to be aware that their body is awakened. And then they need to be able to perceive that their body is awakened as a positive thing. So there are actually several steps before the desire kicks in and they're like, wait, I like this. I want this.
Yeah.
And we're six steps into the process. So just thinking about sex more sometimes works, but sometimes that's the first of six steps before they desire. Mm-hmm.
It's helpful for people to know that that's normal.
Extremely normal. Yes. And much higher for women than it is for men, but definitely a significant number of men experience a receptive type of desire as well.
Mm-hmm. So one of your messages is that you need an encouraging vision for your marriage. And I'm curious about how that would help somebody who's maybe not really satisfied with their sex life right now to set it on a better path.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times we spend time looking at the problems, looking at what's not working, looking at how we're dissatisfied. pointing out how we're missing the mark of what we would want or what we're called to. And my invitation is, what happens when we shift that and we begin to get a clear vision of where we're going? We know in business that's critical. You know, if all I'm doing is stomping out problems, we're in trouble. I need to have a compelling vision that I'm striving toward that allows me to weather a lot of storms, and it allows me to stay very creative in my problem solving. It's no different in our sex life. And because most couples don't really talk openly with each other, they don't develop a clear, compelling vision. They step into marriage not having really talked about it. They just have this idea that it's going to be healthy and it's going to be good and we're going to want it. And then they run into problems and snags, and they don't have a clear, compelling vision that they're both fighting toward. And very quickly, they get off track and things start to clunk along and start to fall apart. So a couple sitting down and talking through, well, why do we have sex? I mean, that's a simple question, but many times they approach it from very different directions. And can they figure out a way to kind of be on the same page? Not that you approach it the same reason that I do, but can we develop a shared vision of why we would get together? How often would we like to get together? You know, what would be the ideal? And most couples are, to go to what you were saying earlier, Rob, most couples are way closer than they realize. The frequency that they pick is often just one step away from each other, where they thought they were going to be 12 steps away from each other. When we do, is it nurturing? Or do we want it to be playful? Or does it need to be erotic? Or, you know, does it have to be romantic? Or can it be romantic? You know, does it have to be focused on one act? Or can sex be this rich menu that we can regularly choose from? And we don't always have the pressure to experience an orgasm or to do one particular kind of behavior. Or is that part of the vision for us? And how long do we want to spend in each different section of our sex life? And, you know, what do we want out of it? What do we want it to look like as we grow older? And as couples start to talk through it and they develop a vision for it, now I know what you're after. I know what you would like. So let's take frequency. You know, a common number for couples is we'd like to, our vision is to have a healthy sexual interaction twice a week. And if that's our vision and we both know that we're striving towards that vision, then when it's been a particularly rough week with the kids or we're caring for our parents or work has gotten off track and we just haven't gotten together this week and the two times that we want, there's a lot more grace because I know that's what you want too. It's not that you're rejecting me or it's not that you're, or maybe I wasn't the best this week and you have stepped away from me, but we both want the same thing. We're both on the same path. We will get there. I trust that you're going to continue to do what you need to get to that vision. I'm going to do what I need to get to that vision, and we'll meet in that middle space. Rather than me stepping back and demanding that you be who I want you to be and criticizing you because you're not where I think you need to be, that falls apart and starts to do damage. Where if it's both, yeah, we didn't hit our goal this week, did we, babe? That's okay. We'll try for next week. Maybe we can make up a little bit. You know, that's a much healthier type of approach because I'm vision focused. I'm not just problem focused on I didn't get what I want.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a minute about this sort of the perception of like, you know, seeing the desire in someone else that you're desiring. And you wrote about this statement, which is, I think, from Cheap Trick, band from the 70s and 80s. I want you to want me, you know, and then there's a couple of other lines there. Is that, maybe that's where you got it from, but you know, that there's a frustration in that line, you know, I want you to want me. I need you to need me.
I need you to need me.
I beg you to beg me. That's the next line.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember my music from the 70s and 80s, but what do you do? What do you say to a couple where the one person, the one side is saying, look, I just want you to want me. And there's this frustration building and maybe not being addressed. You don't really want to control how the other person feels or acts. That doesn't seem right. So where how do you move that kind of a couple into a healthier situation?
I think it's much the same thing. Acknowledging that I think it's pretty human that we want to be wanted. I want to be chosen. I want somebody to find beauty in me, to find value in me, to pursue me. And, you know, a powerful way that we tell somebody that they're wanted is through sexual desire. And so it's, I think, pretty common that it feels good to be wanted. And I want the person that I chose, you know, all the people in the whole wide world I could have had as a spouse, I chose you. And I deeply long for you to want to be with me and to show me that. I think that's very human and very normal. The problem comes in when I start to define how you want me and how frequently you want me and what it looks like when you want me. Because, you know, he may want her to be deeply appreciative, as a husband earlier this week, that he is working so hard for the family. And she's angry that he's not home sitting on the couch cuddling with her, you know, and she wants him to want her in her way. And he's saying, I do want you. That's why I'm working so freaking hard, you know. And so it's getting them to step back and to talk a little bit about it. The other aspect of it is, you know, wanting does make us put us in a vulnerable position. You know, if I want you to want me, I'm saying I need something from you. And the power dynamic that comes into I want to want, but I don't want to, or I want to be wanted, but I don't want to want, is an interesting dynamic that comes into relationship. You know, where one of them may say, I want you to care deeply for me by attending to the details in life for me. And the other one says, I want you to want me by, you know, pursuing me physically and cuddling with me. And how they negotiate the difference in that want is part of the growth and maturing of the relationship. And so sometimes as a therapist, it's just helping to hold them in that space while they figure it out. And how do we care for each other? And how do I let you know that I do want you as a person and as a spouse, and I do want to be with you in a sexual way, but these kind of things have to come with it, or it needs to look this way for it to speak to my heart. And I think that communication piece of getting them just sorting through it, and again, the vision helps them to find a pathway that, okay, we can walk this way. I think healthy sexuality in virtually all of my couples looks different from couple to couple. It's helping them to figure out what's healthy for them and what does it look like. You know, when we're not getting what we want, I want you to want me. And if I don't feel like that's happening, it's pretty easy for me to shift into that kind of critical, commanding, demanding kind of state that we had talked about. And I invite people to shift their thinking there. Instead of, you need to be this, let me take some ownership and shift into, how can I seduce you into it? How can I draw you into it? We're often resistant to use the word seduction, but it's one of my favorite words. You know, seduction goes both ways. You know, somebody can't seduce me unless I'm open to it. But you know, many of the times, if I want you to want me and you're not, I'm not very seductive in my response to it. You know, I act like a child and I start to demand and all these things that make me way not seductive. And I sometimes look and I think, well, I know why your spouse doesn't want you. Nobody would want you with the way you're behaving. What would it take for you to shift to be a more seductive person and to draw them in and get them to where they look over and go, yeah, I do like you. I would like to be with you. I do think I want you. And so rather than demanding that you want me, to shift to being the kind of person that I was when we were dating, and I draw you in, and now you do want. I have the power to be that kind of seductive person. That's how we got married in the first place. And we stepped away from it somehow. So I often invited people to go back to that kind of seductive stance of, I do have some power here in helping us to draw together in the want.
I'd love us to focus on how to deal with disappointments. Now, based on what you've already said today, I'm sure that healthy communication actually factors into, you know, how you deal with an aspect of your sexual life that is causing some disappointment. But beyond that ability to, you know, to really talk and listen and hear each other and maybe get past the potential awkwardness of raising something, can you say a few words to somebody who right now is just feeling disappointed about their sex life and not sure what to do next?
Because it's such a sacred part of who we are, and the longings can be great, the woundedness can be great in this arena, and virtually all couples go through at least one season where it's not all that healthy. My first thing would be, I'm sorry for where they're at. It doesn't have to stay this way. They can lean in and work on being different with it. I think two things that we talk about in the book that are important in this. One is grace. Nobody measures up. You know, I think the best spouse is maybe 80% of what, you know, their partner needs or wants. And the key is, what do we do with the 20? If I realize that, you know, as a husband, I maybe bring in 60, 65% of what my wife really wants in a husband, I'm a lot more humble when I look and, wow, there's 20% of what I want that she doesn't have. When I realize that I am way not perfect and I don't bring everything to the table that she wants, it's easier for me to extend grace. If I believe I'm all that and more, I'm going to be far more demanding, and that doesn't tend to work. So I think the first step is just being gracious with each other. That, again, it helps if we have a vision that we're both striving towards, because I believe you're going to get there, and I extend grace for how you stray off the path at times. But I believe in where you're going and who you're seeking to become.
There is another song from the late 70s, early 80s. And the line is, it was long ago and it was far away and it was so much better than it is today. Is that true? And tell us about sex through the years of marriage. You've done some research on this.
Yes.
And was Meatloaf on to something, or was he out to lunch?
You know, we all change, develop, and grow. That is part of the human experience. And again, you know, sometimes it is grieving that, you know, I'm almost 60 now. And my body doesn't move the way it did when I was 20. And I have to grieve the loss of a 20-year-old body and embrace who I am today and the wisdom and the strength and some of what comes with who I am today. And it's the same with sexual relationship for couples. But what's really cool and honestly was kind of one of the surprises to me is when we look at frequency, for example, in couples over the life span of a marriage, when we ask couples, how frequently do you engage in some kind of sexual activity with each other? I said COVID has been kind of rough on couples. We're seeing, and this is replicated in other studies beyond ours, that as many as a quarter of the couples have moved into a sexless kind of a marriage. Meaning they're having sex less than once a month. So a large number have moved into kind of a sexless state. But of those that are continuing to have sex, the average is about 1.3 times per week. So, you know, over the course of 4 weeks, you know, we're going to be having sex maybe five times. And that doesn't change an awful lot. Early, you know, newlywed couples, it's going to be higher. But within about, you know, 5-10 years, that stabilizes down pretty close to that 1.3 mark. And it doesn't vary an awful lot over the course of the marriage. It slowly begins to dip a little bit. Then we get this bump that happens right around year 30, 35 years of marriage, where we see it bump up again and then drops back down. And, somewhere around the 40-year marriage, it drops slightly below one time a week. And by the time a couple's been married 50 years, we're seeing it a little less than one time a week. But that's not a huge variation. So for couples that are having sex and have a healthy sex life, it continues on into aging. It may not have the intensity. You know, their bodies don't work the way they did when they were 20. And so they learn to be adaptive. They learn how to make it about heart and how to care for each other, which is all really good. But the frequency doesn't really change much. The style does. So the songs, yes and no. Yes, it gets richer. Yes, it gets, I like that word. It just gets richer. It may not have the intensity that it did because my body may not be able to do what I could when I was 20.
Thanks.
So, Mike, I want us all to be able to find you and the book that you're releasing, Secrets of Sex and Marriage, and your resources. How can we do that?
Probably the easiest way. You know, the book can be bought at any of your favorite booksellers. You know, you can buy that online or a local bookstore. To contacting me through intimatemarriage.org. Building Intimate Marriages is where I practice and do my speaking from. So if they go to that website, there's even exercises there that they can do that help them to pursue vision, that help them to talk with each other, encouraging steps on how to kind of get started with some of what we've talked about. And then more information on some of the research is there as well.
Great. At intimatemarriage.org.
Intimatemarriage.org. Yep.
Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Michael Sietsma, for talking to us today. Again, a really interesting conversation, and I learned a lot. So thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, that was such an eye-opening and thought-provoking conversation.
Yeah.
What I took away, I think, firstly, was just how vital it is for every couple to develop a way to communicate with each other openly and honestly about their feelings, thoughts, wants, desires in regard to their sex life.
Yeah, and no kidding. And the pitfalls that might develop, maybe even subconsciously, when we don't communicate, especially like how it relates to how far apart we might be when it comes to physical intimacy.
Right.
Or probably a lot closer than we think if we just talked about it.
Right, yes. And then it's normal for a couple to have one person who has an initiating desire and the other person is more receptive. You know, they'll want the chocolate once they get the idea of chocolate, as Mike said. Yeah. So, those points, I think they can just make such a big difference and help to break down the walls and barriers and frustrations and disappointments that, you know, we sometimes do bump up against, in, especially if you've been married for a number of years.
Yeah, no, I so agree, Tony. So yeah, if you want to find out more about this, definitely get a copy of Dr. Mike's book, which is called Secrets of Sex and Marriage. Well, next episode, we do return to more familiar territory for a pediatrician like myself. We get back into the ins and outs of parenting with our fantastic guest, Dr. Mona Delahook, who has been on our show before and really was one of our highest rated episodes. So we are so glad to have her come back for another episode.
Yes. And so if you have enjoyed this podcast today, please do share it with your partner, share it with a friend. And we would be so very grateful if you haven't left us a review as of yet. Please do go ahead over to Apple Podcasts and just leave us a rating. We would so appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. So thanks for listening again to another episode of the Smart Family Podcast with myself, Dr. Rob Meter, and Tony Newhoff, and another great guest, another great conversation, which we truly, truly hope helps you to love being home.